Hello. Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing me to Barcelona. I've been here already for 3 days, and it's so beautiful. And I'm very tired from walking every day for hours and hours. And in Toronto, it's snowing right now, so I'm really, really happy to be here. I feel sort of nervous about being here. And when I was thinking about what I was going to talk about, and there's always a worry about coming from somewhere else and, you know, telling people what they should do, or thinking I know everything and you don't know anything. And I don't feel like that at all. I've already had a great conversation to realize how many things we have in common. And what I hope is that there are some universal truths, some things that we share, some things that that we can learn from each other. I would love to know more, and I hope there's lots of time for questions about you and what you're doing and what you're struggling with. But what I thought I would do was start with telling you a bit about the organization that I helped found. And in a way, maybe this will help as a kind of case study of a kind of an organization that grew from individual parents into something that's now a kind of institution in Ontario, the province I live in Canada. So I'm going to start by talking a bit about People for Education, and then I'm going to talk about parents and families, and from two different perspectives. One from the perspective of how parents, what the research says about how parents can be most effective just with their own children. And I know we have a tendency to kind of go, yeah, there's that kind of parent involvement, and then there's the other kind. But I think it's important to sort of reinforce that. So to talk about that, and then talk about what parents and families can do and school communities can do as advocates, and what are the things that work really well and the kind of danger areas in that advocacy. So particularly in terms of advocacy, not just for education, but advocacy for children and youth, because I think we have a tendency in education to kind of isolate ourselves from other areas, and that part of the strength of families and parents can come when we work together with the other sectors, if you will, that are working on issues for children and youth. So, People for Education. We started 17 years ago. My children were very small then, and now they're big. And we started really in a time in Ontario when there was, when we had a government that was very anti-public education. It cut a lot of funding from the education system. It started by attacking everybody who worked in the education system. So teachers were going on strike, schools were closing. There was a crisis. One of the government officials even talked about how the way to make change happen was to create a crisis, and they did. So there was a crisis in education, and every conversation about education was kind of a polarized debate. You were on one side or the other side. And both sides were saying, we're putting children first, we care about children the most. At the same time, I had little children in school. I was a parent in a school, and we were being asked to fundraise, which was quite common, still is quite common. But at that time, being asked to fundraise for math textbooks. And we were concerned about what that meant to the kind of fundamental ideal of public education, that it's supposed to give every child a fairly equitable chance for success. What did it mean in the schools where they couldn't fundraise for the math textbooks? Did they just have to go without them? And yes, indeed, at that time they did. So there was this time then of cutting funding, of a government sort of attack on education. And we decided, a small group of parents in one school initially, that it was important that there be some kind of voice in the middle, some kind of objective-ish voice to talk about issues in education and to bring a different perspective to the table, and particularly to bring a different perspective to kind of the public conversation. It was that ideal that drove us, that ideal that every child should have an equitable chance for success. And it was our belief in a kind of civil society way. So we weren't so concerned about education from the inside, how you taught, you know, one thing or the other. And again, I was a theater director. The other people, parents who started this organization were, one was a lawyer, a real estate agent. None of us were educators. But we had this belief, a belief in public education. We had a belief that it could change children's lives. And it could overcome intergenerational cycles of poverty. It could create a sense of social cohesion. It could strengthen our culture because it's really part of who we are. In Canada, about 95% of children go to public schools. And that public education, when it lives up to its potential, can provide children and students with all of the skills and knowledge and capacities they need, not just to get jobs, but to thrive in the 21st century. So that it was important to us that it be the education be broadly based in that way. And so for us, what was important was that we remember and recognize and talk about the fact that the job of public education was to build the next generation of society. So we came at it from this big perspective, and we thought of it really from the outside in. So not so much again from, you know, what was happening inside classrooms, but more what kind of country or province or community or neighborhood did you want to live in, and if that's what you wanted, what was school's role in that? Again, what kind of students did we want to be graduating in order to create the kind of country we wanted? So we grew from this little tiny group of parents. And it was an interesting conversation. We've been talking a bit about how and why we grew. The first thing that we knew is that we wanted to build the public conversation, that we had to get money in order to do this. We applied for funding to foundations, and we knew we wanted to operate independently of the system. So we weren't, even though unions were very active and we were talking with them, and there were various bodies that were very active, we wanted to keep our independence so we could never be accused of being the voice of somebody else. So we work now in four main areas, and the first one is research. And the research for us was important because we knew we had to have evidence, that it wasn't enough to just go around having a big opinion about what should happen, that we had to have evidence to back it up. And we were talking at the time to a group of nurses, and they were saying that they thought that somebody should be keeping track of the effects of policy and funding changes in healthcare, because there were a lot of changes happening there, on tangible things. So they wanted to track the birth weight of babies and things like that, health outcomes. So we decided that in education, that we would do that in education, that we would keep track of the effects of policy and funding changes on schools. So we developed a survey that goes to all the schools in the province. And for us, it was a way, it was that thing about public policy. It was a way for us to, we asked parents to keep track of what was going on in their schools and just to count things. So do you have a librarian in your school, a music teacher? Are there waiting lists for special education programs? How much fundraising do you do? Do you have a caretaker? Things like that, things that parents cared about. We developed the survey with a lot of people that they cared about it and that were understandable. And in a way for us, it was to build that sense that policy wasn't something that lived far away and was very, very complicated and nobody could understand, that policy eventually had an impact, it had an effect on you, on your kids, on your kids' school, and that if you knew enough about it or if you had the evidence, that you could affect it back, that you could have a voice because you had the data there to support your voice. And we actually, at the beginning, which we wouldn't call it now, because we're a little bit less activist now, but we called it arming parents with facts. And it was a very important part of how we started, was that. We, at first, universities thought we were kind of cute and not very important because anybody could count things. But after a while, the universities we started working with universities too, because then we were interested in, so we know if schools have librarians, Does that make a difference to actually to the outcomes in schools? So we started working on with universities on other kinds of reports on the impact on education then of what they had or didn't have in their schools. So we put out these reports. Now we have an annual report that we put out on schools. We have a report on school councils and a number of sort of different special reports on things like special education, the arts in schools, which I still very much care about, things like that. So we do the research so that we can have the evidence to have a voice. We do a lot of communicating, and I think that was the other thing that we knew right at the beginning was that we didn't really want to be a lobby group because we didn't want to be inside the government having secret meetings and making deals. We wanted a public conversation. So we made friends right away with the media. We understood how important it was to tell stories and to get the media on board as, you know, that we were credible, that we weren't going to make anything up, and that they could come to us for information. So we do a lot of work that way. We do a lot of work in social media also, in online. We have online dialogues. We have a big website, as you heard, where people can go for information. But it's, again, to engage the public in the dialogue about public education, because, again, we think it's important for everybody, not just for parents. We do work on policy, so we make policy recommendations coming out of our reports. We sit at some government policy tables, and we work sometimes with policymakers, so when we're bringing out a report, we will go tell the government, this is our report, this is what it says, this is what we think you should be doing. And last but not least, we do parent support. Now, when we started as an organization, we didn't think, even though we were parents, we didn't think providing support to parents was going to be part of our job. It never occurred to us that that was going to be our job. But what happened, you know, we were probably naive is a very kind way of putting what we were. I think that we assumed that all parents could just enter into this discussion and all parents wanted to be there and all parents had the same capacity to be advocates. And that is, as I'm sure you all know, and we should have known too, totally not true. And for many parents, the education system itself is a barrier. So they don't particularly want to be advocates for the education system because they already think it doesn't work even at their own school level, or it doesn't work for them, or they feel excluded on the basis of class, or because they came from another country, or maybe because their children have special education needs for many, many reasons, or because the system can feel very complicated to navigate. For many reasons, I'm sure here too, and in Canada definitely, there were lots of parents who didn't feel part of the system anyway. So asking them to advocate for it was much too big a leap. And not because, I don't want it to sound patronizing, you know, not because they didn't have their children's best interests at heart and not because they didn't know what they wanted, but because the system, again, itself wasn't one that they felt that they belonged to. So we started then developing, we have now tip sheets for parents in many different languages, because really one of the things that we learned is that it was important that we were useful to parents. So it wasn't enough just to come and say, you should all be advocates and we should all talk about these things. Parents had to see us as helpful to them. So we have tip sheets, we have a phone line, parents can phone and ask questions about how the system works. They can ask questions online too. We provide workshops because for many parents, just that navigation of the system is difficult. And one person said, it's as if the public education system works on a series of secret handshakes. And our job was to let everybody know what those secret handshakes are. Because there is a lot of class in education and a lot of people don't feel that they belong. So for me, the beginning of this conversation, sorry, now I'm at the beginning, about parents has to start with that understanding. That's a really vital place to start. We have to start I think by recognizing and respecting and taking seriously how complex the job is of being a parent, just that. And it's funny, but you know, you'd think I would have known that more when I had young children, but I feel like I know it more now that my children are older. Now I know all the mistakes I made. Now I can see it more clearly. And I also know now that there are, that being a parent is it's not easy. It's a very big, huge, complicated responsibility. I always worry that I'm the only person who found being a parent hard quite a lot. I had to live through two teenage girls. I always worry for everybody else it was easy, just for me, that, you know, my children would tell me what a bad job I was doing or how no other parent said things like that. But I think actually for many parents, it's a kind of, it's because so many of us have children, we just assume we should know how to do it. Or, you know, that, it, you know, I always equate it, this is a weird thing to equate it with, but it's like when your parents die, which my parents have done, and you sort of go, oh, well, you're old, of course your parents died. But nobody says to you, even though everybody's parents die, it's a huge, enormous thing to have in your life. So even though a lot of people have children, it doesn't make it any less significant and really, truly complicated an undertaking, where you're always wondering, what should I be doing now? And kind of second-guessing yourself. So I like to start there, even though I know that's not necessarily the topic of this, because I think it's very important when we're thinking about the politics of engaging parents that we recognize first just the plain old job of being a parent and how hard that is. So we have, over the last couple of years, undertaken quite a lot of research then looking at parent involvement. And we did a big, huge literature review just to look at, to see what the evidence was or what researchers were finding around the parent involvement, the kinds of parent involvement that makes the most difference in terms of student success. And we have a tendency to focus on the involvement we can see. And we have a tendency to sort of talk about involved families or involved parents as the ones who are active either in their schools or in this political sphere. But in a way, that kind of doesn't give enough credit to the amount of involvement that parents have at home and the complexity of that involvement at home. So for us right now, one of our most important messages that we're trying to get to everybody in the world and everybody who works in the education system in Canada is that part of their job is to let parents know at home that there are four really important things they should be doing. And we got it down to four because we thought it was important that it be easy enough to communicate to parents. And again, this goes to trying to get away from this idea that there's a kind of hierarchy of parent involvement. There's important kinds and unimportant kinds. And really, in terms of student outcomes, what parents do at home matters more than anything, much more than their involvement in school. So for me, the first job as an advocate is to let parents know that, and that among all of these researchers, 30 years of research from the United States and Canada and England and other countries, and studies of hundreds of thousands of children, there were four things that came out that parents did. And what's interesting for us is that these four things cross socioeconomic lines, they cross, it doesn't matter what language the parents spoke or if they went to university, what mattered that was that they did these things. And the first one was that they have high expectations of their children. And this isn't, you know, fighting about marks, this is just letting your children know that you believe in their potential, that you assume that they're going to work hard, and that in our family, we care about school. So that sense of high expectation was the number one thing that made a difference, and again, to all families. The second one was talking to your kids about school. Again, these sound easy. Our research director, who has a PhD and has a master's degree in law, and you know, is very knowledgeable. Initially, we were writing a tip sheet to say, and we were going to say it's as easy as 1, 2, 3, 4. But then one morning she came in tears and went, "It's not easy. We can't say it's easy," because she'd been fighting with her, I think, 4-year-old about getting dressed to go to school. And that notion that it's easy is, you know, again, we went, okay, we have to recognize it's actually hard. Anyway, number two is talking about school, which isn't necessarily easy. But what was interesting about it was that it was more important than homework, more important than helping with homework at all, more important than limiting TV time, more important than saying they couldn't go out on a school night, was just home discussion, they called it. So conversations about school. So we've developed tip sheets now for teachers and principals, because sometimes you ask your kid about school, they go, I don't know, or nothing when you ask them what they did. So we've developed tip sheets so that teachers can actually make the homework, ask your parents these questions. Thus the conversation about school happens. The third one, which I was worst as a parent, had to do with building good attitudes and work habits for your children. I was hopeless at that. My daughter last year discovered that when you have a job, you have to go every day or you get fired. It took her 4 times to learn that, but I think she's learned it now. So building the work habits, though, is not about doing their work for them. Again, it's not about their homework. It's actually about letting your kids struggle. So it's about letting them learn to be persistent, to figure out how to go and get help, to be able to deal with difficulty and handle distraction and negotiate their own crises. So again, it's not about doing the work for them, and you don't have to be able to do their math or know the history or read the textbook. That's their job. Your job is to support them and get them to learn that this is part of what they have to do. They have to grow up and they have to take responsibility themselves. And the last one I think everybody knows, but not everybody does still, which is reading with your children. And for us, what's important about these things is that there's a lot of research done in Ontario actually looking at how much this happens at home, because they survey kids, and it's not happening at home. So the reading with, again, it's not about teaching kids, it's just about the joy of reading. It's just about the experience of reading with them. There was just a study in the UK where they been tracking kids for a long time. The kids whose parents read to them when they were 5 were doing better when they were 16 on reading, in reading, writing, spelling, math, in everything. So it's it is very important, I think, that we, again, that we take seriously this job, and that as advocates or people who want to build advocacy, that we offer parents this useful information first, and that we communicate this with parents. So for me, it's, you know, first of all, understanding that parents don't necessarily want more jobs to do, even though I know some do. They actually want more support. They want more information. They want to feel that they're not alone in their kind of quest to try and bring up their children to be responsible adults. And so the job of schools then somehow is to build that, to make that interaction happen well. So building school sense, so then the people who work in schools, the teachers, the administrators, the school system sense, that their part of their role has to be communicating with parents, not asking parents to do more, but communicating with parents. That's the first job to do. And parents can be incredibly effective advocates for education, but we have to make sure that we kind of nurture that relationship, because parents don't want to be advocates for education that either they don't understand or that doesn't seem helpful to them. So we have to recognize that communication and communicate with parents where they are. And then if we sort of go the next step and we go, okay, now we've kind of got parents on our side and now they're in the school, and we were having a conversation then about school councils, we can bring parents into the school, but we have to be careful again, because it's easiest, and this is where this conversation gets complicated, it's sometimes we have a tendency to sort of listen to the loudest voices, or even worse, a tendency to think, because my voice happens to be so loud, everybody must agree with me. And we have to watch that, because, as I know you all know, some people have much greater capacity to make their voices heard than others. So we have to really think when we're listening to parents about how we can maintain a balance between real listening and real desire to have that interaction with parents, a balance between that and making sure we're making sure our policies do the best they can for all the children in the system, not just the children of the parents with the loud voices. So first we need schools to recognize the serious job of parents. We need to ensure they're welcoming. We need to build that sense of collaboration. And then we have to think about how we involve parents at the decision-making level. I heard in your introduction that there are parents going, they want to be there, be part of choosing the administrators of schools, directors of schools, I think you called them. That is true. That is happening in some schools in Ontario. But there are other people worried about which are the parents who get to be part of that. Who's really at the table that's part of that? And what we have to be careful of is that sense of social capital, that some parents have social capital, so they have the education, the income, they're born in the country, they are from a certain class that feels that sense of entitlement, that they get to be at the table where other parents don't necessarily. So in Canada, and I hear just as here, in Canada, we're divided. Every province and every territory runs its own education system. It's part of our constitution, so they're totally divided. But nearly all of the provinces and territories have school councils. At the school level, some have some kind of council at the regional level, and some have some sort of provincial representation. It's always problematic because it's really false to call it representative, because you can say there are elections at the school council, but really, usually, if you walk in the door, suddenly you discover you're the president of the school council. That's what happened to me. That's how I ended up the chair of my school council. So it's not as if there are people clamoring to be on the school councils. When they were first set up, school councils were basically set up for two things. One, for accountability, which I think is similar to here, and one to include parents a little bit more in some decision-making processes. And the involvement, the structures across Canada and certainly in Ontario are all sort of effective in some ways and very problematic in other ways and in the same ways. They have increased somewhat the transparency and somewhat the accountability. So there is a sense that there are parents there kind of watching, and that has worked. But they still tend to attract the same very small, not representative group of parents that they always did. In Ontario, nearly half of the students are second generation or visible minorities, but nearly all the school councils are totally white. They're totally middle class. The parents are university educated, so they're not representative at all of the schools that they supposedly represent. We survey school councils all across the province, and we ask them what they think their most important role is. And interestingly enough for us, though they were set up to improve student achievement and to do school improvement planning, they actually say a very small minority list that as their most important role. The majority say that their most important role is communication, and we're happy with that because we think that's their most important role too, is to be able to build this sense of community without parents having to come into the school. But you can make a community if you have the people in the school willing to communicate out. So you can build governance structures that include parents, but we have to be incredibly careful about how we do it. It's not easy, and we have to be incredibly careful about our assumption that everybody agrees with me or us, because sometimes us are not what everybody agrees with. So for us, the hard part has been, and the interesting part, and I think that it's the job in a way, is to, instead of building support for parents to be more active or more effectively involved in certain ways. It's to actually build the space where parents feel that they can be in all their kind of differences, so that it allows for the differences. Parents aren't a system. And there's a tendency in the education system, because it's a system, to want to interact with another system. So it likes to kind of, we like to try to then systematize, which isn't a word, parents. But they're not really systematizable. Their parents have all different political perspectives. They have different beliefs. They come from different backgrounds. They have really strong, really differing opinions about how education should work. We have parents who phone us and go, there should be more homework, or parents who phone and go, there should be less homework, or they want, you know, more math, or, you know, more arts, or they really don't all agree about the things inside education. Some are very, very, very angry about the amount of testing that we have, because we have standardized testing in Ontario in grades 3, 6, 9, and 10. Other parents love the testing. They like it because it's a nice, simple way, they think, to judge the success of the education system. They like it because in the end you get a graph that's sort of up good, down bad. And it's like, excellent, now I know everything I need to know. So we have to recognize that parents come at education from many, many different perspectives. And we have to then try to, I think, and I think from our experience, it's been shown to work this way, that if we can build a space independent from the system, that's recognized by the media, because we think and we are sure that policy really changes by pressure from the outside much more than by the inner workings of the policymakers. That if we build this space where there can be an active voice, and if we look for things on which we can agree, or debates like this, where you can actually debate things that are a little bit more overarching. So right now, People for Education, what we're looking at is, how do we define success in education? And this conversation, you can sort of start to find more agreement, or more people that are willing to have the discussion in a different way. So we're worried that we've narrowed the definition of education by just focusing on reading, writing, and literacy and numeracy. Those things are very, very important, but we're kind of driven by the PISA scores, by the OECD, by the scores on the tests inside Ontario, and that sense that, you know, we've got to get the scores up and then the education system will be better. We're worried that by focusing on that, we put all of our policy, all of our, a lot of funding, a lot of pressure on the system to do better in those ways, and we've lost health as a very important aspect of education, health writ large, mental health, physical health, social, emotional health, the arts, which are really getting kind of squeezed out of schools, a lot of schools in North America anyway, this sense of citizenship, how are we educating our children to be active, engaged, involved citizens. And again, I mean, in Ontario, we measure how we're doing on the test scores, and we measure graduation rates. But we don't talk very much about what kind of graduates are they? What kind of capacities do they have? And those kinds of conversations are ones that we are finding engage more people. The danger is that it's easy to get parents involved when there's a crisis. That is how we started. Our joke always is, meanly, you just have to threaten to close a school, and then parents are instantly involved. And that has happened a lot in Ontario because we have declining enrollment. But the hard part is, how do you keep them there? How do you keep parents there in the long term, feeling that having this voice is important? And I guess what's important is that it's not a voice. It's voices. So now the government in Ontario, and right now we have a pretty friendly government, but it's gone through a few changes. It really cares not just what we say, our organization. It cares because we have thousands of parents engaged with the organization, and they know that. So our job now has become to let parents know about policy, to take academic writing, which sometimes academics, you know, think they're very special and write in their own special language, take that writing and make it into language all parents can understand. So again, parents have the tools they need to be advocates. We're working hard to reach out to other kinds of organizations because we know education is just part of a kind of ecosystem so that poverty, health, recreation, social services, education, they all work together or should, and they all interact with each other. So for us, our advocacy now is about reaching out to other organizations, about building this space for the conversation to happen, building a space where people can wrestle and disagree, but where we can come out with reports that are taken as credible. So it's really in the end about supporting parents, providing them with the tools that they need, building that big kind of tent, which then allows us to talk about these bigger issues. And that by doing that, then you end up with a voice for public education. Sometimes parents will advocate for things you wish they wouldn't advocate for. We have been very surprised sometimes and we've wanted to go, we didn't mean that. We didn't mean you should be asking for that. But we've tried to stay out of it in a way. So again, for us, it's providing the information, providing the tools, providing the sense of support, providing a place that parents can go to, and then saying, okay, you guys go for it. You can have a voice in this way. And I think that it's that independent sense that then allows, that gives parents a lot of power. And I think that up to now, parents have felt, I think that because it's exhausting being a parent, and that if I'm doing something in my children's school, isn't that enough? That it's been hard for them to take those other steps. So for us, it's been about you're already an advocate for your child, and we're going to help you be an advocate for your child. We're going to recognize and acknowledge that that's the first thing you want to do. So we're going to provide you with everything you need to advocate for your own child. And then it's like little steps from that advocacy to advocacy for your school, then maybe advocacy for a whole bunch of schools, and then advocacy for public education. And even in a funny kind of way, it goes back to reminding parents and often teachers too, that this thing that is public education has the potential to be transformative. It's a jewel that we have, that there are many, many countries that don't have strong public education systems. In the United States, they've privatized a lot of their public education system. It's seen as a system that's for poor people and not for anybody else. So it's partly reminding everybody there are lots of problems in the system, yes, but public education is incredibly important, and it has a potential to, as I said, to change kids' lives. So it's again, I've already said this, it's recognizing how serious the job of being a parent is, and then providing the space for parents who want to be advocates, to be involved in the system at different levels, but not assuming that they're all going to agree on one thing or another. I will stop there and have questions.